Our author tells a story of four men who made history, and what is more, all born within a single decade. Henry VIII and Francis I of France are here displayed, plus Charles V of Spain and Suleiman the Magnificent. A saga he will now present. You couldn't find a chapter of history more rich in detail. Will you welcome John Julius Norwich?
Terrible rhyme.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. It's quite true that I have just written this book. I'd wanted to write it for about 15 years, as a matter of fact. It had been sort of marinating in the back of my mind for a very, very long time, because it always struck me, long before I ever actually thought of writing it, that the most exciting period of history was the first half of the 16th century. This is the wonderful moment when, at last, civilization was shaking off the terrible burdens that the church had laid onto it for centuries, where they actually thought that learning was a bad and a sinful thing, where everything had to be dictated to by the church and, of course, by the constant fear of hellfire. And suddenly, it happens a little bit later in England, a little earlier in Italy, suddenly everybody starts thinking again, and they're humanism. They're thinking about human beings are much more important than all this other stuff. And what about us? And they go back to the classical civilization, and they think about and that is, of course, the Renaissance. And suddenly the whole world really changes, and people are out after discoveries of new things, after paintings, sculptures, wonderful architecture. Everything changes in the space of about 50 years. And that's a very, very thrilling thing to happen. And at the same time, incredibly, at the same time, the church, which has already suffered one tremendous battering from the arrival of the Renaissance, gets another one from Martin Luther, because the Renaissance or the High Renaissance and the Reformation happen at the same time. In 1517, Martin Luther hammers his theses onto the church door of Wittenberg, and basically Christianity is never the same again. And then, as if that wasn't enough, of course, you've got the discovery of the New World, where suddenly people realize that the world is not twice, but maybe four or five or six times as big as anybody ever thought it was. And it's not only a new world, but it's an incredibly rich world. And within 5 or 10 years, the galleons are coming over from Spain loaded to the gunwales with gold and silver and precious stones and God knows what. And there again, everything is changing, everything is in flux, but everything is improving. That's the great difference between what happens in certain other periods of time, which we could go into but won't. And it's a thrilling moment. And it would be anyway thrilling, but it's even more thrilling when you realize that at that particular moment, the civilized world as we knew it was completely dominated by these four contemporaries. Henry of England, Francis of France, Charles V of Spain, and indeed the whole Roman Empire, and Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Sultan. All of them were extraordinary, and I've tried to say how extraordinary they were, and incidentally, how they sort of interreacted with each other. Suleiman was, of course, slightly... He was the odd man out, in a way. First of all, of course, he was a Muslim, living a different sort of life, and he didn't really bother what was going on very much with the Roman Catholic Church, which completely dominated the thinking of the other three. But nonetheless, he was, in his own oriental way, very much a Renaissance man. The Turks don't call him the Magnificent. They call him the Lawgiver. He completely rewrote and re-edited the whole of the law of the Ottoman Empire, and reigned over a period of absolutely incredible architecture. All the great mosques that we now see all over Turkey, or nearly all of them, were built in his reign. the great Easnik potteries, which still produce the most marvelous stuff, all started then. He was himself a superb goldsmith, and of course, he was a terrific soldier who got in 1529 to the gates, the very gates of Vienna, before having to turn back because winter was coming, the weather was atrocious, and it was a long way back to Istanbul. But they, all of them, the other three, they knew each Charles, Francis, and Henry, all knew each other. I don't say they knew each other well, but they met on several occasions. Henry and Francis, of course, at the famous Field of the Cloth of Gold, which, again, was something that we find it hard now to believe when we read descriptions of it, how Henry, for example, brought over to it's near Calais now, that spot which had been arbitrarily decided because it was on the frontier of French territory and English territory. And he brought over something like 10,000 craftsmen building these incredible temporary prefabricated castles and fantastical buildings straight out of a fairy tale, which were only going to last for a couple of weeks, you know. The amount of money spent was absolutely unconscionable. We had two huge fountains outside the principal palace where he was going to live, running permanently with red wine. That actually proved not to be much of a success. They were completely surrounded by prostrate drunks and had to be taken away again. But there was jousting, there was carousing, there was dancing. And Henry and Francis, both of them tremendous showmen, marvelously dressed in silks and satins and richest velvets, all both of them trying to outdo each other all the time. It must be the most fascinating moment to watch, and giving each other enormously expensive presents, which neither of them could afford. It was by far the most costly getting-to-know-you exercise in history. And then Henry and Charles V, that was nearly extremely embarrassing because Charles V, just after he had become emperor, was going back from the one half of his empire, which was in Spain, going back to his capital in the Low Countries, so he had to come down the Channel. And he'd only just been elected very recently, and less than a year before. And he said to Henry, "I'm coming down the Channel. I'll stop in and pay you a little visit and say hello." And Henry said, "That'll be fine." But then Francis was very badly delayed by bad weather. Everything in those days, of course, depended on the wind. And there was a southeaster instead of a northwester, or the other way around. I don't know which it was. And anyway, Francis was 3 weeks late. And Henry, the day after tomorrow, had to be at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. You know, can you imagine the attention? Look, I'm terribly sorry, old chap, but I've really got to go to the Field of the Cloth of Gold. Charles arrived just in time. He never had time to go to London. They got him as far as Canterbury, where he met his aunt, who was Catherine of Aragon, the Queen of England. He'd never met her before. And then they very quickly separated and only met once more. And Charles and Francis, of course, Charles and Francis were brothers-in-law, first of all, which made it more complicated in a way, because they hated each other's guts. They had to hate each other's guts, because imagine, Charles had the biggest empire anybody had ever had in history. He had virtually the whole of continental Europe, except France. And here, if he tried to go between the two principal parts, there was a not particularly friendly France in the middle. He always had to go around it. And meanwhile, poor Francis saw himself completely surrounded and penned in by the empire. I mean, it was a very awkward situation for both of them, so it wasn't surprising that they weren't terribly keen on each other. But one of the way Francis dealt with that is by making an alliance with Suleiman the Magnificent. And it was not, as you may imagine, popular in Western Europe. I mean, Suleiman was an infidel. He was Antichrist. You couldn't make alliances with Antichrist. It was absolutely unthinkable. But Francis, nonetheless, did. Because, of course, Suleiman was an immensely valuable ally because he was the other side of Charles. He was the other side of the empire. So you could get a sort of pincer movement coming in. And in the year 1543, I think it was, most extraordinary thing happened. A Franco-Turkish army. Imagine what that meant to Europe. A Franco-Turkish army besieged and largely destroyed the city of Nice. Nice was not France at that time. Nice belonged to the Duchy of Savoy, which was part of the empire. So it was hostile. And they destroyed Nice, this Franco-Turkish army. It was the most extraordinary thing to have happened. And there's a wonderful monument now, which you can see in Nice. I hope if this were an illustrated lecture, I'd show you a picture of it. It's a relief monument of the heroine of the siege of Nice. And the heroine was a girl called Catherine Seguran, and she was a washerwoman. And she, at the critical moment, when the Turks were just seizing the castle, the great fortress in the middle of Nice, she seized the banner from the arms of a Turkish soldier and brandished it aloft and said, "Come on, come on, vive la Savoie," whatever it was, and turned the tails temporarily. In fact, Nice fell anyway, but I mean, she was incredibly brave and everybody thought she was wonderful, and so they did this relief statue of her. There was another theory about the story, that she hadn't actually seized the standard. What she had done was turned her back to the Turks and exposed her bare bottom, which so shocked the Turkish infantry that they fled in absolute horror. I've always been rather sorry that this particular relief plaque didn't show the second version of the story rather than the first one. But there, it didn't. So what can you do? For Suleiman, the great tragedy of Suleiman's life, really, was that this immense conqueror who'd mopped up, by the time he died, mopped up the whole of Eastern Europe as far as Hungary, never actually got Vienna. Because if he'd got Vienna, which he jolly nearly did in 1529, he would have waltzed through into Western Europe, and for all I know, we'd all be talking Turkish today. You know, it was a very, very, very close thing. The Turks tried again 150 years later, and thank God, once again, missed it. But, I mean, all the time, there was this real, very, very, very serious danger. All the people in the early half of the 16th century were living in fear of the Turks. They'd captured Constantinople in 1453. The whole of the Byzantine Empire had gone. They'd mopped up the whole of the Eastern Mediterranean. Venice was no longer mistress of the Mediterranean as she had been. She now couldn't even get into the eastern part of it at all. And everybody was absolutely terrified of these Turks. And Suleiman's last great effort was to destroy the Knights of St. John, the Knights Hospitallers of St. John on the island of Malta. When he'd been a young man, the Knights had been occupying the island of Rhodes, and he had knocked them out. He'd besieged Rhodes as a young man, and eventually the Knights had had to surrender, and he'd treated them very mercifully. He'd allowed them all to leave the island and that sort of thing with their possessions and with due honor. And the Knights had wandered for 7 years, not knowing where to go, until 1530, when they'd been given when they were given the island of Malta by Charles V. They had to pay a rent for it, which was one falcon a year, the famous Maltese falcon. And they occupied Malta then from 1530 till they were eventually kicked out by Napoleon in 1798. And Suleiman, they had promised when they left Rhodes that they would be very, very, very good boys and never attack the Turks anymore. But never has a promise been more regularly and constantly flouted than that one. I mean, they were at it all their time. They were like a terrible, constant pirate organization, attacking every Turkish ship that they could see. And eventually, Suleiman had enough. He was getting old. He was nearly 70. And he thought he was too old to command himself. So he made the cardinal mistake of giving the command to two other people, an admiral and a general, who unfortunately hated each other and and were always at each other's throats, which was one of the several reasons why, in the end, the appalling siege of Malta failed. It went on all through the summer of 1565. It's a very, very nasty story indeed. I mean, the Turks on one side of the harbour mouth nailing Christian prisoners onto crosses and floating them across the harbour, and the Christians on the other side cutting off Turkish heads and firing them in their cannon back across to the other side. I mean, not at all pleasant. But eventually, the Turks run out of food, they run out of water. The heat is absolutely appalling, of course, in Malta. This is all through August and early September. And the wells had all been poisoned by the knights to make quite sure that the Turks couldn't get any of the water. First of all, by putting all their dead animals in and then filling them up later with dead Turks. So the water was far from pleasant. And the Turks eventually just had to go back. A terrible epidemic of flux broke out, and they all had to limp home. But, I mean, there were very few knights left alive at the end of it. I mean, it was very, very nearly a terrible disaster. But Suleiman, of course, was furious and knew that if he'd been in charge himself, it would have made all the difference. Who knows whether he was right or not. And very soon after that, he just led one more excursion into Hungary and got as far as the city of Szeged, which we put under siege. And the first night he moved into his tent and never left it again. He died on the spot of a heart attack or a stroke, we're not quite sure which, and his body was eventually carried back to Istanbul. He was the last of our four princes to live. And then that was the end, because after that, in three out of the four nations that these my four princes dominated, they were succeeded by absolute nobodies, by non-entities who hardly counted. And the only one, of course, the big exception was Queen Elizabeth of England, Henry's daughter. She was as great as any of them, but she was the only one left. So it makes the second half of the century is nowhere near as much fun to write about as the first half. But the first half, with that Renaissance, with that Reformation, with Henry and the Pope and the constant battle with trying to get a divorce from Catherine of Aragon, only because he wanted children, male children, to succeed him. That was really the only reason why he went through six wives and only had one son who died at the age of 15. But his eventual successor, anyway, was Queen Elizabeth, which, as we all know, made up for everything. So that's the story. I hope you'll all buy hundreds and hundreds of copies of my book. I shall be very happy to sign them all, because a book signed is a book sold. And I hope you enjoy them.
For more information about The Oldie, go to theoldie.co.uk. This podcast was produced by RadioGorgeous.com 2017.